My name is Andy. I'm going to be moderating tonight's call. We're calling you tonight to give you an opportunity to ask your elected representatives any questions you have about issues like the state budget, education, transportation, jobs, or public safety. If you have a question tonight for Representative Therringer or Representative Fanaway, all you have to do is press *3 on your phone right now, and we'll connect you with a volunteer who will place you in the question queue. That *3 on your telephone keypad is all you need to do to ask your elected official a question on tonight's call. Again, this is a live telephone town hall, and we're calling you because you live in the 24th Legislative District, and your representatives want to hear from you about the issues that you are concerned about. So if you want to hit *3 right now, get you in the question queue, and we'll get going. Now I'll turn it over to the representatives for some opening remarks.
Good evening. This is Representative Steve Therringer. It's great to have you folks on our teletown hall tonight. And I think Kevin and I have done two or three of these, and they've always been pretty successful. It gives us a chance to answer questions for maybe 50, 60 people, but a lot of other people get to hear on, listen in on the line and hopefully get their questions answered by us answering those questions. So we're not going to get to everybody's question, but we're certainly interested in hearing from you. So thanks for calling in.
And I'm Kevin Vandewig, your other representative. I hail from Squim. And I'll give you just a quick background of the 24th Legislative District. It covers all of the Olympic Peninsula, the upper portion of Grays Harbor County, all of Clallam County, all of Jefferson County. And Steve and I represent you in Olympia, our state's capital, and we pass a state budget and state laws. And that's we're currently in legislative session. That's what we're down here working on, and we're interested in hearing your feedback on what we're doing or if you have questions about what we're doing. So I think, Andy, we're ready for the first question.
We do have a question right out of the gate. Again, if you have a question for the representatives tonight, press *3 on your phone. That's *3, and we'll get you in the queue. First, we're going to go out to Carol, who's got a question about education funding. Go ahead, Carol. You're live with the representatives.
Yes. I want to know how you're going to ensure that education is fully funded in Washington State, particularly in light that the legislature has been held in contempt by the Supreme Court for not following through on funding it sufficiently.
Well, Carol, that's a great question, and that's the question on everybody's mind down here in Olympia. We've just gone through, you know, our policy sort of cutoff, what they call policy cutoffs, so the bills that were introduced in the House went through got off the House floor, went to the Senate, and now we're hearing Senate policy bills, but that work is pretty much done, and so now we're starting to look at the budget. And depending who you talk to, we probably need anywhere between $750 million to $1.4 billion to meet the obligations of McCleary. A number of things that are being talked about to do that, the governor, for example, in his budget, suggested a capital gains tax, and which would raise a base amount of about $400 million, and that would obviously go a long ways towards McCleary. The other things that are being talked about is B&O tax reform, which could get us partly there. And then the governor also suggested a carbon tax and using part of that money to for McCleary. So those are some of the things that have been suggested. I don't think all of those will be in the mix in the end, but I think a lot of us agree that we need to come up with additional revenue to fund our education system.
And Carol, what I would add to that is the McCleary lawsuit, what you said about fully funding education originated out of the 24th Legislative District. It started by a Chimicum parent. And the Supreme Court said that we had 6 years to fund education better. And the state works in two-year cycles called biennium, and we are just starting the second two-year cycle. So we're just starting the third year into this six-year thing, and we've made a lot of funding increases to education, but in these final 4 years, we have a lot of work to do, and a lot of funding will go that way towards education, along with some policy changes to make sure that that money is being spent wisely.
Great. Thank you, Carol, for that question. Again, if you have a question tonight, press *3 on your phone, and we'll get you in the queue. That's *3. Now we're going to go out to Linda, who's got a question about oil trains. Go ahead, Linda. You're live with the representatives.
Well, I want to know how you feel about the oil trains coming through this area because they're ticking time bombs, and I want to know what you're talking about on the carbon tax. You're going to talk about taxing us human beings or the corporations that actually pollute? You said.
Yeah, Linda, this is Kevin. I'll take the first half of your question. Steve will probably answer the second half about oil trains going into Grays Harbor. So, and the rest of the legislative district might not be aware, but railroad tracks go from the I-5 corridor out to Aberdeen, and there's some proposals in place to ship oil along those tracks. And that has a lot of concerns in Grays Harbor, certainly very valid concerns. We at the state level, the way railroads work is they're pretty much very powerful to begin with, and they're regulated by the feds. So we can't like pass a law that says you can't have oil trains go out to Aberdeen. But what we can do and what we're working on doing is some legislation around oil train safety so that if those proposals go through, we'll know how many trains are going, what's on them, when the dangerous trains are going through. Pretty much we'll have a lot of disclosure around that, which I think is smart. We'll also be better prepared in worst case scenario in case there is an incident. And we're also putting some funding into the infrastructure there to make sure not only that the tracks are as safe as can be, but also we're working hard with local Grays Harbor officials to make sure that traffic can flow in and around the trains because it has lots of impacts from Elma to Aberdeen. Steve, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I think, Kevin, you summed up the kind of the legislation, the focus on the safety around oil trains. And as far as the carbon tax, it's the governor, as he's proposed it, it would impact about 130 businesses, corporations, particularly, the oil refineries and the folks that are, generating a lot of carbon. Not to get too much into the weeds, but it's if you emit over 25,000 metric tons, you would have to buy a permit that would, in fact, there'd be an auction process for buying permits that, would meet your obligation. Those dollars would generate about $516 million in the 2015-2017 biennium, and then it's up to $1.2 billion in the 15-17 total revenue. So, and that money would be broken out between education, transportation, and then part of the dollars would go to mitigate some of the industries that are being impacted by that added fee. But that's the governor's proposal, and there's discussion just going on now within in the House and Senate about whether that proposal makes some sense and whether it will move forward.
Great. Thank you very much, Linda, for that question. Again, if you have a question, press *3 on your phone now. We'll get you in the queue. Next, we're going to head out to Roger, who's got a question about Representative Vandeweghe's music performance bill. Go ahead, Roger. You're live with representatives.
Yeah, I was wondering, perhaps, let's say a school decided to put on Oklahoma or Carousel, would they have to pay residuals to Rodgers and Hammerstein?
Thanks, Roger, for that question. And I want to give just a little background on this bill before I answer your question. I have legislation this year that would regulate music licensing agencies, and those pretty much are three nationwide companies that own copyrights to almost all music that's ever been produced, or a large majority of it anyways. New York-based companies come into Washington State and they attempt to collect copyright licensing fees from a vast majority of small businesses, meaning bars, taverns, music venues, dance studios, churches, farmers markets. Pretty much anybody that plays music pays them a fee. They have some pretty shady business tactics, and they can be very coercive, they can be bullying, and small business owners don't know a lot about them. But they legitimately own the copyrights to this music. So again, much like oil trains, we can't outlaw them. They have a federal right to do that, but we can regulate them. And I have some legislation that says they can't use coercive language. They have to give notice before they go in. They have to go in at normal business hours. And if they don't do those things, they can get a $1,000 penalty assessed, or a business owner can use the Consumer Protection Act in their defense. So it's just kind of some basic regulation. They also have to file with the Secretary of State, pay a $1,500 filing fee, and that fee we're going to use to communicate with business owners about their rights. You specifically asked about school districts. I don't know, but I would guess schools probably pay a BMI and ASCAP. Those are the couple of the licensing agencies. They probably pay them a fee every year. I know the city of Sequim, for instance, and I think most municipalities do pay them a fee just based off the music they play. It's pretty wide range. I would imagine schools do that. The bill is very much alive and doing well. We got it all the way through the House. Right now it's in the Senate. It's been received pretty well, but it's a really a new topic for a lot of people. So doing a lot of educating for my colleagues about what this bill does and kind of the histories between the companies. A lot of our small businesses on the Olympic Peninsula have been active and writing legislators, especially those from other districts, key legislators, and I greatly appreciate that. It's been incredibly helpful, and we'll see how it goes. Hopefully we'll get something to the governor's desk.
Great. Thank you, Roger, for that question. Again, for those who are just joining us on the call in the last few minutes here, you're listening to a live telephone town hall with Representative Steve Theringer and Kevin Vandeweghe talking about the issues that you're concerned about. If you have a question, press *3 on your phone right now, and we'll get you in the queue to ask your question to the representatives. Next, we're going to go out to Brian, who's got a question about the marine tourism bill. Go ahead, Brian. You're on the air with the representatives.
Yeah, yes. I was wondering if Representative Theringer thought the marine tourism bill would move forward this year and be brought to a vote.
Brian, it's a very, very timely question because we're going to hear that bill tomorrow in finance. And this bill has been sort of knocking around the legislature for a few years. And I think this year, I've signed on the last couple of years, but this year I'm the prime sponsor. And I think this year we've got it right, and I think we're going to get it out of the House, certainly out of the Finance Committee. This is a bill, for folks that aren't familiar with it, it has to deal with excise tax on large boats that come into the waters of Washington, and after 60 days, they have to pay 10% of their value. Like on day 61, they pay 10% of their value. So a lot of the larger boats don't do that. They go to Canada or don't stay here. And so we're losing a lot of marine trade activity and other economic benefits from these larger boats staying in our waters. And so what this bill is going to do is change that to a fee based on certain footage and lessen the amount, because there's been some studies that have showed that that would probably generate close to $25 to $30 million in added economic activity in our boatyards. And obviously for the 24th District, when we go from, you know, Hood Canal up and around through Port Townsend and Port Angeles and down into Grays Harbor, we have a lot of waterfront and a lot of marine trades folks. So I think this will be a good jobs bill for us in the 24th, and I feel pretty positive because we've worked the bill pretty hard and we've addressed a lot of people's concerns. So I think we'll get it done this year.
Great. Thank you for that question. Again, if you have a question, press *3 on your phone right now, and we'll get you in the queue. Next, we're going to go out to Judith from Sequim, who's got a question about fireworks. Go ahead, Judith. You are live with your representatives.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call. I live in Sequim, and I know that Port Angeles has recently passed a ban on personal fireworks, and Port Townsend has had one in effect for a while. So I went to talk to the mayor about the possibility of getting this on the agenda for Sequim, and I was advised that there's a bill or bills pending in the legislature that would override these personal fireworks bans in both cities, and so therefore there's no sense in going ahead with trying to do the same thing here.
You're right. There was some firework legislation. I think there might have been some confusion on what they did. The fireworks legislation, and I believe the Senate bill might still be alive, although I highly doubt either one of them will be signed into law. What they did is they said a municipality can either ban fireworks or they would have to follow a state structure on how to regulate them. So, for instance, I believe, like you mentioned, Port Townsend has a ban on them. That ban would be able to stay in place. What the reason there's a lot of controversy around these bills and the fact that they won't probably ever be signed into law is it takes away a lot of local authority. If, for instance, Squim wanted to say, hey, you can light off fireworks, but we're only going to allow fireworks on July 4th. We're not going to allow them any other day. If this bill passed, Squim wouldn't be able to do that. They would either have to ban them or follow the state structure around fireworks. So there was no middle ground, took away a lot of local control and power of cities, and I don't think people are just really interested in doing that. I think they want to allow citizens like yourself to approach their city leaders and find creative ways and useful ways to regulate fireworks and regulation that works for that local community. So I don't think either of those fireworks bills will probably be passed into law this year.
Excellent. Thank you for that question. Again, if you have a question, star 3 on your phone right now, and we'll get you in the queue. Next, we're going to go out to Eileen from Port Townsend, who's got a question about forestry. Go ahead, Eileen. You are live with your representatives.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. Yes, I actually had two questions concerning the Olympic National Forest and the DNR land that is south of Squim in the mountains there. I had read an article a while back about the Navy considering doing some kind of high-tech magnetic field weapons testing in the Olympic National Forest, and then I never saw another article about that, and I wondered what, if anything, was happening with that. And perhaps I'll let you answer that and maybe ask my other question after that.
Well, you I don't know if you'll be able to stay on the line, Eileen, but the issue you're talking about, I think folks recognize this issue, is the Navy electronic warfare, the Navy Growlers, they're called, I think they're E-6s, jets that come out of Whidbey Island. They're proposing a electronic warfare testing site on the west end of the peninsula out along the Pacific coast, and they want to put what happened to be sort of transformers similar to what you see for TV stations. When you see a mobile TV station, they want to put those out in the forest and then be able to have the jets fly through that course to check their ability to deal with jamming and other electronic warfare techniques. And my understanding is that the number of flights won't increase, but that the number of missions will increase. And so that in one flight, they can do numerous missions to test out the various types of different electronic warfare. I think Congressman Kilmer has been doing a really good job. Quite frankly, I don't think the Navy did a very good job of doing outreach to the people that were going to be impacted, and that's a lot of the citizens of the 24th Legislative District. And Congressman Kilmer has gotten the Navy to do a number of public meetings and get a lot more public process into that Navy proposal. I'm not even sure that the Navy has, at this point, filed a formal request with the U.S. Forest Service or with DNR on the issue, on the training sort of training sites. But I do know that the Department of Natural Resources, I think, sent a letter to the Navy sort of stating that we're not really that interested in this going on in our public lands, and, you know, you should probably talk to us if you're thinking about moving forward with this. And I don't know if, Kevin, you have anything to add to that.
That's pretty specific answer.
I think really talk to Congressman Kilmer's office about this, because I think they've done a really good job, and it is kind of a federal issue because it's federal forest land and the Navy. but I think his office has really taken the lead on this.
Thank you, Eileen, for that question. And unfortunately, we have, well, fortunately, we have a long list of people in the question and answer queue to ask questions tonight, so we do have to limit folks to one question. If you do hang on the line at the end of the call, you can leave a voicemail for your representatives, and you can ask additional questions if you need to. If you want anyone else on the line want to get in the question queue, press *3, and we'll connect you to a volunteer. Next, we're going to go out to Sue, who's got a question about the state library. Go ahead, Sue. You are live with your representatives.
Good evening. I'm with the Jefferson County Council of the Blind, and under the Washington State Library is the Washington Talking Book and Braille Library, which is the only way that blind, visually impaired, and many physically disabled people have of getting books that they can actually read. In the current budget, there is a $2.4 million shortfall for the Washington State Library, and I would ask each of you to seriously look at whether you could reinstate that shortfall to provide library services for our elderly citizens in this county.
You bet, Sue. Thanks for bringing that to our attention. We're aware of it. We've been aware of the library funding in the past, and I think we've always done a good job of filling that gap. And I know this year, when we're creating our budget, the state library is certainly something we're going to be watching and hoping that we can get it funded. I think the House version that Steve and I are obviously here in the House of Representatives, we're going to put out our budget soon, and I feel pretty confident that there's going to be some robust library funding in that. But the Senate is a different chamber, and we have to end up negotiating a budget, and we're going to work hard to hope that the state library is funded in that final budget, and we'll try to get there. I know the constituents of the state library do a wonderful job of lobbying for that. They love their facility, and we appreciate the phone call. And you guys not only use the facility well, but do a good job of sticking up for it and making sure it's funded.
Great. Thank you for that question. Next, we're going to go out to Tim, who's got a question about vocational schools. Go ahead, Tim. You're live with your representatives.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My question is, as you know, a lot of kids aren't going to college as people think they are, and more importantly, the number of kids that do go to college that don't finish is very low. I do want to know, I have read and heard that there is some bills out there that are looking at increasing CTE classes at the high school level, which would be fantastic. Can you share a little bit on what's going on with that and let me know?
Yeah, and this is Steve, and I'll start out, and I think Kevin will follow up. You're right, and I think both Kevin and I support a stronger link to for students whose aptitudes tend to the vocational and the skill training as opposed to, you know, higher education or college. In our community colleges, Peninsula Community College up in Port Angeles with Satellites and Forks in Port Townsend, and then Grace Harbor Community College, a couple of the best within the 32 college system. And what this bill does is sort of, you can do something like Running Start now as one program, so where you could be a high school senior and then actually go to the college. And then there are some programs where you can stay in the high school and get college, credits. But the technical piece is really, I think, this is a complicated equation, at least the way I understand it. You know, with the testing requirements and a lot of the other requirements, graduation requirements, it's been difficult for scheduling for students in high schools to schedule what we used to call, at least when I did this, was shop class, where you'd have, you know, these different introductions to the different skills. And I think what we're trying to do is look at those other requirements and testing requirements that are impacting the student's schedule so that they'll have more time to pursue some of these skills and training skills that I think fit maybe their aptitudes better. So I think there's three different bills on graduation rates, and then there's two different bills on this interface between the community colleges and the high school and getting those credits, you know, either at, on campus or in the high school itself. I don't know, Kevin, if you have some stuff to add.
Not much to add other than if we put emphasis on CTE classes, which are wonderful classes. I used a lot of them when I was in high school, and they taught me skills that I still use every day to this day. If we put more emphasis on, in there and expand that at all, it's gonna cost us money, and that's money that we're trying to come up with. We're trying to use your tax dollars as wisely as possible. We're making a complicated and large budget. We're under pressure from McCleary, and maybe that some of this funding can be counted as McCleary funding, but the state Supreme Court has set some pretty rigid framework for us to do that in. So we're doing the best we can. As Steve mentioned, we both agree with you. CTE is critical funding, and we'll do what we can to get some emphasis put there.
Thank you, Tim, for that great question. Next, we're going to go out to Eric, who's got a question about transportation. Go ahead, Eric. You are live with your representatives.
Yes, I have a question, comment. What is up with this proposed gas tax? We already pay the second highest gas prices in the United States due to taxes. Why not live within your budget, cut unnecessary spending so the middle class is no longer punished because of mismanagement of budgeting?
Thanks for that question. So the Washington State Senate, the other chamber, as opposed to the House of Representatives, where Steve and I are, the Washington State Senate has passed a gas tax increase, and it has now come over to the House. I will mention as an aside that the Senate is controlled by Republicans right now, and they are in favor of raising gas tax because they have some infrastructure and transportation projects they want to see done. Our Senator, Jim Hargrove, voted against that package when it went through the Senate. Steve and I have both indicated that we have some pretty strong concerns about this project. I have come out and said if the project doesn't change, I would be a no on it. And I really don't see a way that I could probably get to yes. I agree with you. Our gas tax is high. It affects the constituents on the Olympic Peninsula a lot because we drive a lot of miles. And we also have a lot of transportation projects we have just finished up, and we're in a very fortunate situation. We have a remodeled Hood Canal Bridge and a freeway between Sequim and Port Angeles and a lot of other work's been done. There's still some more that can be done. I'm not sure it's worth a large gas tax increase, though, to see that happen.
Yeah, and I think I told the media when they asked me that I was somewhat concerned about the gas tax. I think it's important for us to realize that we have not funded we have not had a transportation budget in 3 years. And so we're falling behind in our transportation infrastructure, particularly in the I-5 corridor, and particularly trying to get goods from to and from our ports. Trying to get, I think, the goods over the passes. There's some major transportation challenges that I think the state faces. On the Olympic Peninsula, we're doing pretty well, although, Kevin and I, in looking at a transportation package, have tried to get some funding for, we spoke earlier about oil trains and then just the rail line in the Grace Harbor area. There's a lot of folks that are down there or they're listening. They know that rail line goes right through Alma and right through Aberdeen. And I know there's some engineering going on now, but I think it would be helpful to get some funding to separate the roadways and the rail line so that they're not impacting, because that's a huge link, vital link to the port there, which is one of the major economic drivers in the harbor these days. So I'm not categorically finally opposed to a gas tax. One of the things that's being talked about is a carbon, you know, the governor has suggested this carbon tax. And if you look at the state's carbon footprint, about 46% of it, I think, comes from transportation. So there may be some sort of connection between that carbon tax and transportation, but that would be discussions that will go on for the next couple months down here as we try to work these things out. So, you know, I think the fundamentally we need to make some investments in our transportation infrastructure. How we do that remains to be seen.
Great. Thank you for that question. Again, if you've got a question tonight, press star 3 on your phone, and we'll get you in the queue. Next, we're going to go out to Matt, who's got a question about income inequality. Go ahead, Matt. You're on the you're live with your representatives.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question has to do with income inequality. It's one of the biggest issues facing, I think, our entire country. And in Washington, we're usually rated, I know we're consistently rated as the most regressive state in terms of our tax structure. And given the needs for revenue and projects and all the things government needs to do, how can we reduce our income inequality and work to fix our progressive tax structure?
Yeah, Matt, this is Steve, and I couldn't agree with you more. The data is very clear because we're so dependent on the sales tax in this state that, you know, the lower 20% of the population pays about income of the population pays about 17% of their income in taxes, while the upper 2 or 3% only pays about 2% of their income. And again, that I think that's because we're so dependent on the sales tax, and that's a regressive tax. And so the governor's proposal on the capital gains really targets that, because that would tax it's an excise tax on people's buying and selling of stocks and bonds, you know, so hedge funds and folks that are basically, you know, investing in equities, they would get taxed on the exchange of those equities. And the way it's being proposed by the governor, I think that would impact about 31,000 families or 30. And there's a deduction there for $25,000 for if you're single, $50,000 if you're a couple. Your retirement savings would be exempt, so your 401k and your IRA would be exempt. Your primary home would be exempt. And so it would really target just stocks and bonds and that equity income. And I think hopefully we can agree. I mean, this recovery has been more of an equity recovery than an earned income recovery. And I think that's another reason for us to give some serious consideration to the capital gains tax. And I think that would help us address the inequality that you mentioned.
And I would agree with Steve. You know, we're in a tough spot with this major court decision and putting more money into education, which isn't a bad thing. Education needs more money. Our kids need the tools they can get to succeed in a global environment. We're just under a lot of pressure to put a lot of funding in there quickly. And so we have to seriously look at revenue options, raising taxes. And when we do that, we need to be careful not to affect the middle class folks, the people that go to work every day, that are working a couple of jobs, that are doing manual labor or working in restaurants or working outside, delivering goods. Those folks are taxed enough, and that makes up a majority of our constituents. So Steve and I are really concerned about that. The capital gains tax stays away from the middle and lower class environments in Washington. Really taxes those people that that are the upper income level. As Steve mentioned, about 31,000 people will pay this a year. But Washington has a population of just shy of 7 million people. That means one out of every 225 Washingtonians will only pay this tax. And I believe a lot of those folks can afford to pay more. And when we're put in this crunch where we have to look for revenue, I think that's who we should go after. I mean, we never want to raise taxes, but when we have to do it, we want to raise taxes on those that can afford to pay.
Great. Thank you for your question. Next, we're going to go out to Annette from Port Townsend, who's got a question about vaccines. Go ahead, Annette. You're live with your representatives.
Good evening, gentlemen. First, I want to thank you both for your dedication and your work. I really value that you've chosen to do this for us. I consider this truly a public service. I'm curious about the status of HB 2009 regarding removing the exemption, the philosophical exemption for vaccinations, to the philosophical exemption to avoid vaccination. What is the status of that bill now?
Well, Annette, thank you for the question, and thanks for your support for the work we're doing. That bill is dead. It did not get to the House floor. I don't think there's a companion bill in the Senate, so there won't be any legislation on it this year.
And I'll just give some more background on vaccines. There's really three ways that a family cannot vaccinate their kids and still send them to public schools. They can use a philosophical exemption. There's a religious exemption, which is really wide open. You don't have to have a letter from a priest or anything. It's just you just claim a religious exemption. And then the last one is medically inhibited for the patient, the child, to receive a vaccine. This legislation would have closed down one of those, the philosophical one, and we're one of the few states that still have a philosophical exemption. Most states have never enacted it or taken action to close it down, as we have seen the rate of unvaccinated children skyrocket. And Washington is one of the states that leads in having unvaccinated children. And with the recent measles epidemic, that's something that we look at seriously from a public health standpoint here at the state. We want to protect all the children, but the ones that are in public school are a concern. So even if this legislation had passed, of course, the medical reason would always be there, and every state has that. But also the religious exemption would still be there for those that whose convictions don't allow them to believe in vaccines. But as you mentioned, that legislation is not around this year. Unfortunately, I think that we'll still that legislation like this will be back quickly and probably be more powerful in the future, because I think we're going to see outbreaks of things that we thought we had cured, things that we have vaccinations for, and that will probably give power to bills like that in the future.
Great. Thank you, Annette, for that question. Next, we're going to go out to Jackie from Port Townsend, who's got a question about the Public Disclosure Commission. Go ahead, Jackie. You're live with your representatives.
Hi. I wanted to thank you first for co-sponsoring the Joint Memorial 4004 about constitutional amendment. And I know there are a lot of things, a lot of needs out there. And I agree with the capital gains tax, and I think a progressive income tax would help as well, because one of the things that we need to fund is the Public Disclosure Commission. And they've had budget cuts every year for, I think, 4 or 5 years. They need to update, and what's going on there? Thank you.
Thanks for that question. And, you know, I want to start off my answer by saying the Public Disclosure Commission, well, first of all, Washington State has a reputation of having probably one of the best Public Disclosure Commission. And for those that don't know what the Public Disclosure Commission is, that is what shed lights on campaigns. Every when we're running for office, every cent that we raise and every cent that we spend, we disclose where that money came from and how we spent it. And we have to do that for everything. And our Public Disclosure Commission does a very good job. You mentioned the point, though, of the PDC taking cuts, and they are a state agency that a lot of people don't know exist, but that the general public benefits a lot from, because they keep campaigns open, and any citizen can see who's supporting what candidates and why and how those candidates are spending their money. I think that's very important. I think Steve agrees with me. But people are telling us now, as we recover from the economy, like, we're collecting more tax dollars. Why can't, you know, you guys have enough money? Well, agencies like the PDC have been, I mean, during the recession, we just had to cut them. I mean, there are agencies like that sometimes got cut over 50% of their budget from pre-recession levels. They're doing a lot more work with a lot less staff and a lot less technology. And I bring that all up as being a point, an example of a state agency that needs to, that we need to get funding back to, because they provide a valuable service, for the public. As far as the campaign stuff, we support you. I mean, having open campaigns is important. And I don't know if there's anything you want to add there, Steve.
Well, I would just add, Kevin, what you mentioned. I mean, we heard about the State Library. We're hearing about the PDC. And there are a number of these agencies that I think are important to the citizens of Washington. And yet our revenue structure has been declining since 1983 based on a personal income basis. I mean, we're paying less personal or both state and local taxes than we were in 1985 on a personal income per capita basis. And yet the population's growing, the demands are growing. If you look at mental health, you look at education, but you also look at these agencies within the state that really, you know, provide a great service for folks to make sure the government, and in this case our campaigns, are accountable. And so I think that's kind of the fundamental question we need to be asking as we go into this budget is, you know, what kind of state do we want? What are we willing to pay for? And, what is it that, I think the era of something for nothing is sort of ending, and we need to step up and maybe make some tough choices around improving Washington's revenue structure.
Great. Thank you for that question, Jackie. Next, we have Sherry from Elma, who's got a question about marijuana revenue. Go ahead, Sherry. You're live with your representatives.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I live in the part of Elma that is considered county, and we have marijuana facilities that are popping up. And I want to know what the state plans on doing with that money, if they plan on funneling it back into the communities, or what exactly do they plan to do with it?
Well, your question is very timely, Sherry, because I sat on the Appropriations Committee, and we had a hearing, actually, on the marijuana excise tax today. And there's quite a bit of debate about it. To start out, there's one question about whether we share it with local government or not. And I think the decision is if a local government or a local area is generating the tax, i.e. they're allowing, producers in the retail sales, then they would get a portion of it. I think local government, both counties and cities, are a little concerned about, what their share is, because the current proposal caps that. But most of the money, about 15% of the money, will go to Department of Social and Health Services for within the behavioral health area for prevention and treatment. And then part of it goes to the Department of Health for, for ad campaigns and education around marijuana and the use and what may be the impacts. And then there's a amount that goes to community health centers, about 5%. And that leaves roughly about 18%, almost 19%, that goes into our general fund for general expenditures. And the projections on what these revenues would actually be are really hard to pin down. I mean, what we're trying to do is bring together, under the Initiative 502, the recreational piece and the medical piece, because the medical piece is kind of outside the 502 system. So we're trying to bring those together and then just provide a excise tax or a sales tax on the final sale of the product. And the idea is that will generate more revenue because it'll hopefully compete more effectively with the black market or the gray market, which is those cooperatives and collectives that were out there that are actually, I think, producing a pretty bad product is what I'm hearing for the medical marijuana folks. So the projections are really very, very much a projection. It's hard to say what those dollars will be. But within the biennium, it could be close to $270 million for 15-17. And then out in the 2017-2019, it could be about $550 million.
Great. And I'm actually not going to speak any to that question, but I just wanted to, because we got about 10 minutes left, so we got time for great questions. And as Andy mentioned a number of times, if you want to ask a question, press *3. But I want folks to be sure to realize that we have a very engaged district. There's probably well over 1,000 people on the phone listening right now. And if we don't get to your question, you can leave a message. You'll have an option to leave a message at the end. But I want people to realize that typically when we've done these in the past, we can have hundreds of voicemails left, and it's going to take days, if not weeks, to get back to you. Of course, we will as quickly as we can, but we're going to be working hard to get back with everybody that does it. We have a very involved district, and there will be a lot of work for our staff. I know Linda and Leanne are here tonight working. Amber, our intern, is here in the room with us, helping us with these phone calls, and they'll all be very busy along with Steve and I in the next coming days.
Great comments, Representative Vandeweghe. Yes, you have a very engaged district here. We got a lot of people looking to ask questions, so we'll get to as many as we can. Next, we have Denise, who's got a question about mental health. Go ahead, Denise. You're live with your representatives.
Well, first off, I want to say I know Senator Hargrove has been involved with this in the past, and we really appreciate that. With the large numbers of offenders that have mental health issues, what are we doing to help law enforcement to learn how to deal with these individuals on the street and to know the special characteristics and ways that we need to deal with these offenders in order to make sure that everyone is safe and everyone is getting the kind of justice that they need?
Denise, that is a really, I think, important question. And there have been a couple of bills that have highlighted the need for better training for law enforcement so that they have some understanding of mental health issues. We have a couple of court cases that we're trying to respond to as far as, the idea of boarding where people with behavioral health, mental health issues have been put in the hospital where they're not getting the appropriate treatment. I think a big part of our budget will be focused on addressing these issues in both in the community and then treatment as we move forward. And we talked just earlier about the marijuana revenue, and I think a big chunk of that, that 15% that goes to DBHR, the Department of Behavioral Health, is to address those issues. So I don't know, Kevin, you might have something to add to that.
Yeah, the two things that I want to add is a bill we passed called Joel's Law this year, and when somebody's in a mental health crisis, the state has a law called the Involuntary Treatment Authority, which means if a police officer or a judge finds that you're not capable of taking care of yourself, you're harm to others, that you can be treated for that mental crisis against your will. Joel's Law allows families of folks that have mental crisis to go in and say, hey, my son or daughter is really troubled right now. We think they might be a threat. Take a look at them. And it helps families be able to do that. And that's a big step. And there's been some unfortunate examples where somebody that was in crisis quite didn't meet the threshold for the system to involuntarily treat them, but the family was begging for them to be committed, and then they still went out and did some very damaging things. So I think that's a huge step, and that bill we passed this year, I think the Senate's going to do it, and I think it's going to become law. And just one other one that I want to mention briefly here is early learning. We're putting some mental health emphasis in early learning. I think if mental health can be recognized in kids early on, treatment is much greater chance of being successful, and we can help those children as they turn into adults be guided through their communities well and have less crises, and that means having less cost for the state, less concern for the family, and in some cases less victims for crises that are severe.
Excellent. Thank you for that question, Denise. Next, we have Ed, who's got a question about the state budget. Go ahead, Ed. You're live with your representatives.
Thank you. Well, the first thing I want to say is another thank you to both of you for all of your dedication to our district and your service. You guys are fantastic. So I could make some comments about education and just say that I hope that in considering funding education, you're looking at the full spectrum. You talked about early childhood education, and the other end of the spectrum is important as well, and that's higher ed. But my real question is about the state budget. What portion of the state budget is open or available for any kind of change? When people talk about making adjustments within your means, what portion of that can you actually have an effect on? And the second question and a follow-up to that is, if you were to want to change the tax system, even in regard to the carbon tax or the capital gains tax, what's the process for doing that? So I'll leave and you can answer.
Dr. Brewster, that's a great question, and thanks for listening in. So we have about 66% of our budget is just protected for services, and about 34 has a little more discretion. We, of course, have the constitutional language that says funding K through 12 is our amply funding K through 12 is our paramount duty. So, and then we have debt service that we need to pay off, and so the maintenance budget, and there's debate actually between our side of the rotunda and the Senate about just what is the basic maintenance, and in fact, what do we need to just maintain services. And then what's the additional dollars we would need to expand services, for example, in McCleary? We think that it's about $39 billion in that. So when you hear people talk about, well, there's this additional $3 billion that the state has generated in revenue, can't you just use that to meet the additional McCleary numbers or obligations? And the challenge is that when we make decisions, say, on what class size is going to be, or what level of poverty people will be able to access safety net services, we build sort of a caseload, and then as you move that caseload forward, you need to maintain those costs. It's sort of like, you know, you've got your insurance on your car and your car payments and your rent, and as those go up, maybe you then have to cover those costs. And so that's basically taking care of that additional $3 billion in revenue. So anything new we want to do to expand higher ed and keep tuition low, or to expand slots and programs in community colleges, for example, or to address some of the mental health issues we've talked about, those are additional dollars, and we need to generate those additional dollars, and that's why we're looking at these other revenue options such as capital gains and maybe B&O tax reform. I know, Kevin.
I don't have anything to add. I don't know, Andy, if we have time for one more question.
We do, yes. We have Clint from Forks who's got a question about jobs, job creation. Go ahead, Clint. You are live with your representatives.
Yeah. I was just wondering what you guys are doing about creating jobs in Washington State, especially out here on the Olympic Peninsula. We hear a lot about raising taxes and stuff like that, but seems to me that if we create more jobs, we'll bring additional revenue into the state.
Absolutely. You know, probably the best way for somebody to be successful in their community and successful human being is to have a job. You're able to pay taxes and be a vital member of your community and make sure your kids have good education, and you're obviously a lot less likely to create a crime. So job creation is certainly our number one goal. And we do a lot of things legislatively and also budget-wise to do that. I mean, Steve mentioned earlier his marine trades bill. That's big for Westport and the other shipbuilders that are in our district. Obviously, some big employers. I also am working on a marine heritage, which is more around the tourism side of job creation, but clearly the Olympic Peninsula is a very, very beautiful area. We make a lot of money and create a lot of jobs off tourism. A lot of people come and visit us, and promoting that best we can is always a priority for us. Some of the larger employers in our district, Cosby Mill down in Grays Harbor, Nippon in Port Angeles, Port Townsend Paper in Port Townsend, big, big private employers. We're working with them constantly to make sure that they're doing well. And we've done a lot of legislation with them and for them in the past to make sure that their profit margins are something that's sustainable and they can keep those jobs. Before we create new jobs, we want to make sure we're retaining the jobs we already have. So stuff around biomass energy are some of the things that we've done for those mills, and they've worked out well. Now, in Grays Harbor in particular, we've done a lot of big things. They are building all the 520 pontoon projects. That's a bill that we worked really hard on a number of years ago, and we're able to make it happen, and that's kind of getting towards the end of its life. They're about done with those pontoons, but that's something budget-wise that we've been able to do for our district where it created some great construction jobs replacing a bridge that's in Seattle, and we got the jobs out here.
Yeah, Clint, I would just add a couple of things to what Kevin said. Our district, the 24th, has a lot of timber land, and I think, as you probably know, a lot of that private timber is being shipped overseas, so we're trying to work with DNR and the U.S. Forest Service to see if we can get some more fiber off the landscape. I think DNR is doing better. I think the U.S. Forests they're unhealthy, quite frankly. I don't think they're being managed that well. So we're having discussions with to see if we can get some more thinnings in that. And then there's discussions around that, what's called mass timber or CLT, which is laminated timber, to try and develop new products for that smaller dimensional log and timber that can be used in the building industry. We talked earlier about transportation and transportation infrastructure. The rail line down in Grays Harbor is huge. They have become one of the major ports for shipping automobiles to and from Asia, and they're shipping a number of grains out of the Midwest that are shipped to the Philippines and to Korea and to Vietnam. And so it's if you look on the map, it is the closest port to Asia. And so making sure that rail line and those roads are maintained and provide that really vital transportation link to that growing asset down there. Jobs are tricky. There's no real silver bullet. I think the key is to work on all these issues kind of at the same time and just develop the sort of inherent strengths we have, timber, shoreline, great tourism options to just kind of grow all the sectors of the economy.
Yeah, and go ahead, Andy. Go ahead.
Oh, that, unfortunately, Representative Vandeweghe, that is all the time we have tonight. Do you have a brief closing remark on that question? Or?
Not on that question. I just wanted to let people know that we appreciate them being on the phone. I was going to kind of close up and have key to if people have questions, concerns, problem with state agencies, to call us anytime. It's easy to get Steve and I's information. You can Google Kevin Vandeweghe or Steve Theringer. We usually come up. Google Washington State Legislature. It will guide you to our contact information based off a couple of questions. We're usually printed in the newspaper, our contact information. But we love to hear from constituents. And really, we're in session right now, so we're here to serve you. And we're a big link between you and state agencies. If you're having a problem, if you're a small business or a constituent or whoever, and you're having a problem with state agency, we're happy to help you solve that problem.
Yeah, and I would just add, thanks for listening, and do follow up if we didn't get to your question or to your issue. Get in touch with us. Kevin and I have two of the best legislative assistants, probably in Olympia, Linda Barnfather for Kevin, and what's your name again? Leanne Horn, who just does a great job for me in my office, and they're really good at solving constituent problems, and they make sure we get your messages when they come to our office. So thanks for listening and calling in.
Thank you.